You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. This week's show begins a month of episodes about newspaper comics, which is to say interviews with creators of strips and one-off cartoons featured in newspapers. And to kick off, I'm talking to artist and writer Glenn Baxter about his work, which has been featured in The Independent, The New Yorker and Le Monde, and has also been the subject of gallery exhibitions around the world, including one currently running in London at Flowers Gallery in Cork Street until Saturday the 5th of March. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. Resonance FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
You've been published as a cartoonist now for over 30 years. And at the moment, you've got a gallery exhibition on Cork Street. As someone who started out studying art at Fine Art School, was the idea of exhibiting in a gallery environment something that had always appealed to you? Or as a cartoonist, did you prefer just seeing your work in print?
Well, actually, I had actually no ideas, no possible vision of what I might ever become or try and make a living at doing it. And after art school, I was very disillusioned with the art world. Yeah. And I got interested in writing little short stories and bits of prose things. And I moved down to London, and I used to hang out in Better Books in Charing Cross Road. And I just got intrigued by the what was then the American poetry scene in New York. Mm. Partly because a lot of the poems that I liked from the French Surrealists and the Belgian Surrealists were being translated by New York poets. So I got hooked up with that whole New York school, really. Mm. And I didn't think that there was any way of making a living out of doing anything other than teaching and reading your favourite poems at late at night, you know, and just hanging out and just absorbing the atmosphere, which was like the 1960s, 68, so it's kind of quite a vibrant time in London. And I also, I shared a flat with a fellow teacher at that time who was in a thing called The People Show, which Jeff Nuttall had started in Better Books in Charing Cross Road. Mm. And it then moved to the Arts Lab in Drury Lane. And for a while, it was an incredible epicentre of all the kind of avant-garde music. And they showed Warhol films there, and they showed, what's his name? Kenneth Anger films, right. Yeah. And things that were just not available anywhere else. And there was People Show, and there were films, and there were art exhibitions, and a coffee shop, and all kinds of weird people from all over the world were kind of passing through and getting involved in that incredibly vibrant time. Mm. And I was part of that briefly. Hmm. And I went to the Edinburgh Festival, actually, and with the People Show, and I actually appeared on stage at the Travers Theatre as Inspector Baxter.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. So at that time of your life, really, in terms of career that you might have been considering, the world was your oyster. You hadn't really sort of chosen a life for yourself.
No, I think a lot of us didn't really. The world events were moving so fast, mm. and they were so turbulent. The Parisian students were on the streets, you know, and the American embassy was under siege. People were protesting about the Vietnam War. All of America seemed to be caught alight. And there seemed to be a genuine movement, which we all sort of felt part of. And, you know, as Groucho Marx said, whatever it is, I'm against it. There's that kind of attitude that we were kind of just searching for something different from the old fuddy-duddy ways that seemed so boring and drab, and trying to, you know, echo what was going on in the world of music and avant-garde theatre and filmmaking. And it seemed to be just at that moment in time, it was as if the possibility for lots of things to change was actually there. And we were right in the centre of it, which was great.
Mm. Were you doing cartoons just as a hobby then, perhaps with a more political edge?
No, I didn't really... I never really thought that I did cartoons. I was doing, I wrote a couple of scripts for the People Show, and I wrote some sort of rather embarrassing short prose poems that were published in New York by a little stapled together magazine called Adventures in Poetry. And in 1974, I went to New York they invited me to come and read my poems at St. Mark's Church, which was like another kind of arts lab type experimental theatre, avant-garde podium where Merce Cunningham, Andy Warhol, William Burroughs, everybody had been through there and read and done performances. So it was kind of amazing to be, you know, riding on the coattails of all that kind of, what to me was glamour, you know, and excitement. And I left a rather drab England and went to America, and I stood up in my tweed suit and I read some of I read from the pulpit in the church. And the audience just went berserk. They just fell about laughing. And I'd never really had that response before. And I thought, this is great. People are actually, you know, something's happening here. And I'd done some drawings that I was a little bit shy about showing to people. And the Americans just loved them. And they took them to the Gotham Bookmark. And they had an exhibition in 74 of some early things that I'd done, which were... They were like pulp and comic magazine covers, like Weird Tales. Mm. I did Weird Gardening Tales and Weird Knitting Tales and Tales from the Crypt of Crochet. And they were based on those incredible American comic covers and magazine covers that were so vibrant and powerful that I really had been overwhelmed by. And it was my kind of way of... infusing a bit of humour into that and then like giving an English English perspective to it. And so that was my first batch of work was actually that.
Mm. And thinking back even to the poetry of the Surrealists, when you see the work in print, there's quite often a very strong graphic design element to it. They'll have words in one kind of block type face on one line and then a smaller type of text on the next. So even then, they're not quite art, but there is an element of artwork to the production. I mean, was that something you were thinking about at the time?
I began writing as a way of escaping the tyranny of abstract art when I was at Leeds College of Art. And there was nothing that was happening at college that was of any interest to me whatsoever. Mm. But I was interested in Dada and Surrealism. And I loved all the isms. And I loved Surrealism especially because it seemed to encompass poetry, film, you know, theatre, if you consider Raymond Roussel as a Surrealist, and painting and drawing. But it was... the fact that popular novels like the Fantomas novels have been championed by the Surrealists as examples of great art, and the films of Fantomas also Fouillade, and all those kind of it seemed to be there again like a wonderful turbulent connection that I was really interested in, and also it was all part of the absurdity that which was very appealing. Mm. And looking back on it, I remember that as a child, we used to go to the cinema an awful lot, three times a week, because they used to change the films. But in those days, they used to just run the films on a loop, so they'd go round. So you would often go in the middle of a film and see, I remember seeing a film called 10 Tall Men, which is about Foreign Legion. But so you entered it in the middle, completely lost as to where the narrative drive was, and they had to kind of invent things and then come to the end and then come back to the beginning again. So there's always this sense of fractured narrative about going to the cinema. So the cinema to me wasn't a linear experience. It was this kind of mad, absurd, chaotic thing where you had to kind of somehow claw your way through this maze of absurdity to try and fashion some sort of sense of normality about what you're experiencing. And I think I failed.
And thinking of the combination of comedy and surrealism, I guess that was a good time to be working in those fields in New York, because it was when Monty Python were at their height, and that's very much a kind of British comedy that America always seems to have taken to its heart.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember when I was a student and I came home from art school and my parents were watching a Busby Berkeley film on television, which we just recently got a television set, actually. It was Dames. And I couldn't believe it. It was just surrealism, you know, and crazy syncopated rhythms and this mad movement and this vision of this complete maniac, Busby Berkeley. And I said to my mum, I said, you know, why didn't you tell me that, you know, surrealism was alive and well and coming out of Hollywood, you know, Warner Brothers? She said, oh, it's just a musical. And I said, no, it's not. It's something, you know, deeper and more disturbing and more fascinating than any of that. Mm. And so then again, that fitted in with my idea of the of surrealism, that it goes across all barriers of, you know, of novels, poetry, filmmaking, you know, drama, whatever. And yeah, so that was that really. That's how that connection was there.
You spoke about the tyranny of abstract art at art school.
Yeah.
I take it that the kind of art that you were making was something that was disapproved of by the tutors.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I was thought to be a complete waste of time. Because I'd made little pictures of figures sitting in rooms. One of them was three people sitting around a table with a big cannon on the table with a ventriloquist dummy. And this was thought to be what's going on, you know. But I was more interested in that idea that by entering the cinema halfway through, you see these peculiar things which are part of a narrative, but you've missed the first part. So you're trying to kind of recreate some sense of it, and these images which are so potent and like in Hitchcock film. When Cary Grant goes upstairs with a glass of milk and it's lit from inside, there's some incredible things going on there which you have to follow through, and the power, and you know, Hitchcock was a great believer in absurdity as well. So I was just feeling my way, really, trying to find a voice, and trying to find a voice that was, I thought, particularly English, because At the art school, everyone was painting these sort of secondary American abstract paintings, which to me it just didn't resonate. It didn't ring true. I wanted to do something that was somehow English, but also infused with that European sense of you know, surrealism. And I was just trying to find my own voice, really.
And the idea of walking into a story that's halfway through in media res, to use the posh term.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that's obviously very prevalent in your cartoons, that you'll have an image where all sorts of things could have happened narrative-wise beforehand, and then the text that you add to it is quite often a surreal juxtaposition to what you're looking at anyway. So in terms of approaching images, was that something that always interested you, thinking of what would be an entirely different meaning of what I'm looking at rather than a more traditional?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I didn't see them, and I don't see them as cartoons. I saw them as pages from a lost book, for instance. And I was very much inspired in this direction by Max Ernst, who made those books of collage of steel engravings where he took existing books, Victorian novels with lots of steel engravings in them, and he juxtaposed these images to create this other world, this darker, more mysterious, this more haunting, enigmatic, absurd world with, you know, bird-headed men and strange things going on, which I thought this was really brilliant. But I didn't want to use the medium of steel engraving because I felt that it had already been used so brilliantly by him. And it was pointless to be just a follower of that technique. And there were many people doing things with steel engravings. But I was trying to find a way of making a some sort of narrative drawing that had that, that the authority that the steel engravings seem to have with this sort of this press, you know, this line, this dark, you know, this bite into the very paper. And I came across these loads of these old boys' annuals, and they were all drawn by these factories full of hacks who were just sketching these stirring tales. And I thought, that's it. It's that kind of, they had that, the quality of that stamp of authority, the black ink on the white paper that I was trying to find. And so I took that idea and just manipulated them and changed them a little bit, and I learned to draw in that way. So I recreated that world rather than use the collage technique, because I thought the collage technique had been it was played out basically, and we're looking. I was looking for some other way of arriving at that idea of juxtaposition without it being a collage, where you can see the scissors and the paper and the cut. I want it to be seamless and to be more disturbing and more worryingly inexplicable. So that's what I was striving to do. And I just saw that in terms of a storytelling rather than... That was my main thing, really. And because I was interested in political cartooning, I wasn't interested in cartooning, other than from, you know, admiring certain people, but I didn't want to be a cartoonist. And I wasn't interested in the topical political side of it at all, and still I'm not. I mean, you know, it doesn't move me, but stories do.
So, the initial few examples of work that you did that you had published, what sort of venues did you approach? Was it magazines in New York, book publishers? Because even, I mean, looking at your style, I can imagine that then you'd have possibly been able to find a career as a children's book illustrator if you'd wanted.
I tried to get my work published here in this country, and was people, they either fell asleep during the interview, or just kind of I don't know, just were not at all interested, and told me to go and draw like other people, go and draw like Ronald Searle, or, you know, change your style, do this, that, and the other. And I thought, this is terrible. And I believed that what I had was something different and something special. I mean, they could never see that. And so typically you think, well, you know, all the world is wrong but me. So I just carried doggedly blundering on. It was going to New York that really crystallized it for me, because then the Gotham Bookmark published a little six-page book called Fruits of the World in Danger that I'd made, which was a series of drawings about fruit, which were in danger. The first one was an orange on a railway track. The second one was a grape falling over a huge waterfall. And they kind of got they got what I was about, really. And so having that support and their enthusiasm really tided me over for the next few years. I was constantly going to New York and giving readings, poetry readings, and exhibited my work at the Gotham Bookmark Gallery. And I'd given up on England. I thought there was nobody was interested at all, you know. And I was happy just to be published in the little Sam Is That publications from Adventures in Poetry, you know, and be part of that underground scene in New York. And there again, I was teaching in a secondary school in Islington at the time, and wow. So I was trying to live this double life. But I couldn't see any other way of doing it, you know, and there didn't seem to be any money in it or any possibility of having a career in it. And it was only later that changed, you know.
Well, and I know you're an illustrator rather than a cartoonist or a comic book creator, but actually your story of starting out doing sort of artist prints and doing little published editions seems to be a way that people still try to break into the industry. If you go to something like the Affordable Art Fair here, or the these many kind of self-publishing fairs that they have around London, there are still people who find that the only way of expressing their work is to actually kind of self-publish pamphlets or whatever kind of content, because it's so hard to get your work out there. But obviously publishers do eventually look at this work, no matter how obscure what you're making may appear in your own opinion.
Yeah, I think in many ways, I think it's actually easier now because you can actually do things on the computer and publish little, really well produced little efforts. Mm. But when I was starting out, the only way I could think of was to get postcards done on a letterpress set from a little printer in Clapham, and try and get the postcards into shops somehow and to sell them, and go around with the carrier bag, which I did do, and I used to go to the ICA and try and get them to take some, and they would often take three of one, you know, and four of another one, and six of that one, you know, and in fact, one of the most one of the best-selling postcards they ever did, they ever sold there, was one that they thought would they'd never sell anything. Mm. It was a picture of a man who seems to have sawn his leg off, and he's holding it in his left hand, and there's a little boy and a girl looking up, and the caption said, "Uncle Frank would keep us amused for hours," and they thought it was horrible, and everybody just loved it, and they sold like 15,000 copies of this, and they didn't know how to pay royalties, so I had to go in there and demand them. But at that time, there were two of us. There was a guy called Johnny Starlin, who did some little collage things, rather nice collage things from old magazines, and he was doing kind of radical alternative postcards when there was no competition, nothing else existed. So our work really, really stood out. Now it's like the floodgates are open. Now it's impossible now. It's pointless, really. So many people copied me and they copied him. And riding on the coattails of all that, it just became a huge growth industry. So that was the way of getting your work circulated, was to do these postcards, really. Mm. Which was... It was difficult because people still didn't like them, you know. And it was only that by a complete fluke that in 1979 I had a phone call from Sam Dineen, who was working at the ICA, and somebody had dropped out of an exhibition space, which was, they called it the Concourse Gallery, and it was the corridor between the front door and the bar. Mm. And they asked me if I had enough work to show there, and so I said, "Yeah, of course, I've got tons of work nobody wants." So I took it down, and I realised that it's a very clever place to show because you're between the bar and the toilets, so people are going to pass this place many, many times, and so I had my first public exhibition there in 79-80. I had a show in Covent Garden in 78, a little gallery there, but I hadn't actually reached a huge audience yet. And when this show came on, Valdemar Janáček reviewed it for The Guardian and gave it a glowing review. And the people mentioned it on the radio, talked about it all, and people were really getting enthusiastic. And I thought, what's gone wrong, you know? And I had Thames and Hudson, I had Jonathan Cape and Knopp from New York knocking at my door to publish my work, and I literally couldn't believe it because it was gone from obscurity to insanity in a couple of weeks, and so that's what really, really changed it for me.
Mm. And your first thick book, as opposed to a pamphlet, was published in 1979.
First proper book. Well, actually, I did a book called The Works for a girl called Jenny Tannenbaum, who works at Gotham Bookmark.
Mm.
And it was published by Weird, WYRD Press. And she was going to do a whole series of weird little booklets. It was a paperback book with my drawings in it and some poetry, some short prose pieces. And unfortunately, she only did my book. She was going to do an Edward Gorey book because she used to work with Edward, but it never happened. So that was the first proper book. But then the first European book was called Atlas, and it was published in Amsterdam by De Harmony. A Dutch publisher came to London and was sitting at a rather boring meeting, leafing through some London magazines, London magazine, and he saw my work was a couple of pieces in there, and he really liked it. And so he sort of got in touch and came to my exhibition in Covent Garden and asked me who my publisher was. And I said, well, I haven't got one. So he said, would you like to come to Amsterdam and do a book with me? I said, well, it'd be great. So that's what I went to Amsterdam. We'd laid all the drawings out and we selected them to make that first book. And that was how I came to be published in Europe for the first time. I think he sold 6 copies of the first book.
The start.
Yeah, but he stood by me. He stood by me. Mm. You know, he's a friend to this very day. Mm. And but it took a while. It took really. It took Jonathan Cape and Knopf to really give me that stamp of approval. That actually, it might be possible that this person might be of some merit. You know.
And you were just working in black and white back then.
Yeah, because. It was impossible to do anything in colour. It was too expensive. All my first drawings were big drawings in colour. Mm. And of course, that was completely out of the question. So black and white was the way forward. And I used to work on a smaller format, working towards books. All the drawings were smaller then. And then and gradually I moved back into colour when things, you know, picked up a little bit, really. And also colour printing became more accessible, as it is now. I mean, now it's just incredible now. Now, everybody wants colour now. Mm. Nobody wants black and white. But in those days, colour was like just a luxury that nobody could afford, really.
Yeah. Because I was going to say, I interviewed Raymond Briggs a couple of years ago. And because he was pigeonholed as a children's illustrator, he only ever got racked in bookshops with the children's books and so on and so forth. But because he was published as a children's illustrator, it meant that he could actually do comics in a format and using media that no other comic book artist could use, because the likes of Jonathan Cape would reproduce his beautiful colour artwork perfectly on the page, while if you're working in comics at the time, you'd only be able to do black and white artwork that then would get reproduced quite badly.
Yeah.
So even for being pigeonholed, he was quite lucky in a way that he was able to see his art reproduce well. So as you were being approached by the likes of Jonathan Cape in those days, did the idea of doing your work in colour suddenly become more realistic because you knew that there was a market to have it published in colour?
No, it didn't actually happen that early on. In fact, the books I did with Jonathan Cape and Knopf were all black and white. Okay. The first book that had colour in was the Thomas Hudson book, Glenn Baxter, His Life, The Years of Struggle. Mm. That had a few colour pages in it, which I found... That was a very attractive proposition to me. And also the first edition had special edition with a limited edition with some colour lithographs in it as well. So that was also an appeal. But funnily enough, because my first book was called Atlas in Holland, it was published in by Jonathan Cape as Atlas, and I actually saw it in the Atlas section at W.H. Smith's.
Fantastic.
So this is a way of avoiding the pigeonhole, you know? Call your book Atlas, you know. It's great.
It's interesting though that you're kind of considered, don't take this the wrong way, as like a British institution, but actually you had an international recognition before you had a British one in many ways.
Yeah, I couldn't get arrested in this country. I tried, but it was New York that really kind of crystallized it for me and was so pivotal, you know, to making me realize what is possible and achievable. Mm. And then Holland and then of course France.
Mm.
France with a great tradition of bande dessinée and graphic appreciation of graphic art. You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, like, if they have a big exhibition of Daumier in Paris, which never came to this country, but I mean, it's so close, but so far away. You know, in fact, my first show in France in 1986 or something or other, was in a museum in Sable de Long, a proper museum, you know, with, you know, incredible, with pillars and doors, you know, and they're taking it all very seriously, and I had colour work and lots of black and white drawings and a retrospective, and then that's when I suddenly thought, well, actually, you know, the French really do understand this, and it's part of that graphic tradition, you know.
And translating the text into French, was that ever problematic, or did it always work quite well because it's the juxtaposition of the text and the image?
Yeah, it seems. I mean, I have a team of people who do it, and generally people think that it's very good, which they find equivalent as what I'm trying to say. The only problem was when I did a drawing of some cowboys, and when I said describing how they talked, I said they drawled. There's no French word for drawl. So they spent 3 days at the Pompidou Centre looking through all these books to find out an equivalent, and they couldn't do it. They were scuppered because it's a smaller vocabulary. But but generally, they tell me that it's very close in the spirit of, you know. Mm. Which is fine, because my friend Ron Padgett, who's a poet, who lives in New York. He's translated a lot of Benjamin Perret and Apollinaire, and he translates in the spirit rather than to the letter. So you have to go with that, really.
Mm. There's a much abused term that's used to describe thick comics these days, the graphic novel. Would I be right in thinking that the first extended narrative you did was the Billiard Table Murders, or had you done stories that ran over a selection of pictures before that?
I can't remember. The first definite, deliberate, shall we say, attempt to make a novel, a picture book with a story, was Billiard Table Murders. Because I'd done so many books of fragmented drawings, and I thought, well, it'd be a challenge to try and pull this together to have this little narrative thread. And that was my first attempt to crack that one.
Mm.
And I took all the drawings and all the text, which is incredibly complicated because there's all different chapter headings and timings. Mm. And I took it all to Amsterdam, and my Dutch publisher helped me to, because he had a bigger table than I've got, and we laid it all out. It was easier to see it, or just needed to have to be able to see it. And he was very, very helpful with that.
I've not read The Billiard Table Murders, but I have read Loomings Over the Suet.
Oh, yeah.
And in that, yeah, it's another fractured narrative. It moves forwards, backwards in time.
Yeah.
There are many images in it that still work as individual gags alone, as well as working within the narrative. When you approach a book in that way, that works on various levels, whether it's a single page or a sequence or the book as a whole, was that something that you found quite challenging, or did it actually come naturally because perhaps you had almost like a rep company of characters that you'd been returning to over the years, and so you actually had maybe extended their lives in your head already?
I tried to recreate the juxtaposition and the sense of being lost and trying to scrabble to understand what's going on that I get in the free song between the drawing and the text. I tried to recreate that by having you turn the page, and often the narrative would go over into something else and take you into unexpected areas. So the actual physical act of turning the page and holding a book in your hand was something that I wanted to explore, that aspect of it too. Because, I mean, to me, that is the great thing about books, is that they lead you on and on and deeper and deeper, and they're enthralling, and they're objects, and there's a magical quality to them which nothing else can have on a screen or on a Kindle or whatever. Maybe that's heresy to say that.
No, I agree.
It's just that the books have that quality. And that weight, and that, there's something. I mean, from a child, I remember being, you open a book and you're transported. You know, it's fabulous. You know,
Well, and in terms of the physicality of the object, I guess that's something about your gallery work that's probably quite unusual for fans of your work, that they may only normally see it reproduced on a small scale in black and white or whatever. But when I went to Cork Street earlier in the week, it's the first time the day I've seen the original objects of your work, you know, the original pages as pieces of art rather than reproduction, and then also seeing them at that size. It was quite a surprise to see a drawing of yours that was 4 feet across, for example, and also the lovely texture of whatever pastels it is that you use on the watercolour paper.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I try to recreate that wonderful moment of astonishment that that I remember seeing as a child and in paintings that I loved and experiencing things in films, in books and, you know, paintings. I try to recreate that moment of wonderment. If you enter the gallery and you see this huge colour picture, you know, I hope that that is like equivalent to my first experience of being just blown away by, you know, seeing a Magritte or to seeing a, you know, a Fantomas film or something. And the scale of it is so dynamic that that helps, I think, to, you know, to transport people. And some people, some sort of fascist regime. Yeah. But, you know, to actually engage them in it.
Yeah.
And I just want people to experience, you know, the joy and the wonderment that I experienced. If I can do that, I'd be really happy, you know.
Well, and also because the drawings that you have on display in Cork Street at the moment are all gags about the art world, to actually see them as works of art in an art gallery kind of reinforces the humour in a way.
Yeah, I mean, everyone loves, you know, the art world loves all the art drawings, and I've done a lot of drawings about cowboys discussing Kandinsky and Malevich and Hepworth and so on and so forth, and it's something that there's a lot of things in the art world that are not at all funny, you know, and they're quite drab and boring. But then occasionally you see something really fantastic, like Christian Marclay's The Clock, you know, which is completely brilliant, you know. And I thought that was one of the best things I'd seen for years, because it's funny, it's also kind of moving, and it's also tragic. It's got all those elements to it, you know. And you can really just be enthralled by that. I went 4 or 5 times to see that show. It was great, you know. So yeah, that's what I try and do.
While we've both spoken about how real books and real prints are very nice, on your website you've turned some of your drawings into simple animations.
Yeah.
Where did the idea of that come from?
Well, people always said, you know, if your drawings move, they'd be even, you know, even better, you know. And I thought I was intrigued about the possibility of taking of a simple one like Big Al and the Tulips, which is actually, it's like a little section from a film, you know. And I love, you know, from a child, seeing things in films or so was fascinating to me. So I did that. And when they did a South Bank show about me years ago, they animated some drawings there. Okay. And I was intrigued by that. And I'm just working with on the screenplay of the Bullet Temple Murders at the moment. Got a fantastic young director who's wants to make a full-length animated film of the Bullet Temple Murders. He's written a great screenplay based on, you know, on my book, taking it further. And it will be 90 minutes long. And we've been talking to a French animation company called Prima Linea in Paris. And basically everyone's very excited, but it's just a question of raising the money, because it's not just me sitting at my desk just drawing away, and it's got low budget work. This is going to involve a lot of money, so it's now in the hands of the money raisers. And but you know, it seems to be going well, so fingers crossed for that.
Well, and if they do raise the budget to make the movie, are they intending to reproduce the texture of your artwork as well. Because thinking back to someone like Raymond Briggs, he's always been very well served by animation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I couldn't agree more that the Snowman is classic. It's so much like his pencil work. It's just perfect. And the French company were very, very keen to make it like the drawings. They love the drawings. They love the colour. And they think that would be a stamp of an authentic Baxter, you know, animated film, rather than just any old film. It has to be like a Baxter drawing, but come to life, which is, you know, which is good, I think, you know.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
For more info about Glenn Baxter's work, please visit his website, www.glennbaxter.com. And for more info about his current exhibition, which features illustrations with a comedic take on the art world and runs until March the 5th, 2011, please visit www.flowersgalleries.com. As Glenn mentioned, he started his publishing career by making self-published booklets and postcards of his work, which got him greater attention in the publishing world. And if you'd like to see the work of possible stars of the future, the London Comic and Small Press Expo is taking place on March the 12th at Goldsmiths College in New Cross, which is accessible on the 171 and 172 buses from central London, as well as via the East London Line, newly extended to Highbury and Islington, and regular trains from Charing Cross and London Bridge. Artists selling their work include Yuri Corrie, Timothy Winchester, David O'Connell, Sarah McIntyre, Hugh Rain, Luke Pearson, Edward Ross, Rob Jackson, Dan Berry, Douglas Noble, and many more. Plus creators David Hine and Shaky Kane will be giving a talk about their work, including their recent surrealist pop art homage to EC Comics' The Bulletproof Coffin. That's at Goldsmiths College, New Cross, London, March the 12th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. More info at www.thefallenangel.co.uk. Later that evening, in the same location, there's the first of this year's Comica events, and Lorenzo Mattotti and Dave McKean will be discussing their visionary approaches to comics with Paul Gravett. Tickets for that are £3 and bookable online. More info at www.comicafestival.com, and the event starts at 6 p.m. For more info about today's show and to hear a longer podcast version of my interview with Glenn Baxter, please visit my website www.panelborders.wordpress.com, and Panel Borders will be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.